Today I want to wear a phrase, but I don't want to wear a one-liner. You might think, how does one wear a phrase? I'm still figuring this out. I guess I would wear it on my shoulder. I would drape it. I would drape it in such a way that the sentence might slid off my shoulder sometimes, and that it could be taken up by the wind, but my hand would make a recurring gesture of readjusting it to bring it back in its place. This idea of wearing a phrase came to mind recently through the page of a book full of dense and tumbling language. Hidden in between many meandering sentences, there was this part about how to carry, how to wear a small sentence, a phrase. And I thought, how beautiful. I don't want to show up with too much, but neither with nothing. Last summer, a sprout and its bandages got into a fight. The bandages, made of delicate layers, had grown almost unnoticed into soft, all-embracing proportions. They did not stretch tightly around the sprout, but rather formed a warm blanket, a comforting embrace of conversations full of understanding looks, of interesting invitations, of many texts, theoretical, witty, polemic, and of even more images of great beauty to envy, distracting. Do I have to explain it further? Conversations full of understanding looks, as in, yes, there must be room for opacity, and no, it is difficult. I just don't know of any available apartment in Amsterdam right now, but will think of you, and why do you do all that work while the students are not interested and you will never get a permanent contract anyways? Interesting invitations as in, join our reading group, become our new board member, come to the preview of the opening, listen to the conference on forms of listening, and lots of open calls as in, residencies in a redeveloped industrial building on the Tallinn coast, a gathering on the French Riviera, a 3-week stay in a library in the Swiss Alps. Many texts, as in the appropriated text of the glamorous punk writer who died in the 90s, studies on radical forms of pedagogy, professional text for funding applications, project plans, don't forget the short bio, long discussions on Facebook timelines about privilege, race and identity. Images, as in many flowers. There's something about media artists and theorists mainly posting flowers and pictures of their garden, deconstructed fashion, early medieval paintings, club girls in revealing bratty outfits. The sprout gradually became further and further enwrapped by all of this. Wait, when will I let you know that the sprout isn't really my invention, but is a metaphor from Adrian Piper, and she explains it all very carefully and precisely, drawings included, on the first 20 pages of her book Escape to Berlin from 2018, just so you know. Okay. So that sprout seemed to be very comfortable, wrapped in all those layers, enveloped by images, text, understanding looks and interesting invitations. But appearances can be deceiving. And sometime last summer, the sprout started to resist. Did it start with drinking in the morning? Picture an old school bar with its name painted by hand on the window in elegant curly lettering. It was 11 o'clock in the morning, the sun was out, summer mosquito bites were itching, and the sign on the table was winking at us. A small sign with the Amstel logo, the Pilsner brand my grandfather used to drink. A beer then? Yes. Two pairs of eyes confirmed to each other, and there was pleasure in the air, no shame to order, just pure joy. And when the glasses clinked, glasses with a fine golden edge, and the cool beer touched my lips, this moment felt like the highlight of the day. That same summer, another sprout, who preferred to be a wind, had unexpectedly come to a halt. This sprout arrived on a bicycle and carried a package with her, a plastic shopping bag. I peeked inside and noticed a tangle of threads covered in small, heart-shaped leaves. It was a Ceropegia woody, also known as the chain of hearts or rosary vine. M had carefully bandaged the delicate branches around the plant. We tried to disentangle them together, unwrapping the plant, heart swirling on the ground, and figured that the soft branches were about 2 meters long. The rosary vine had expanded, its tentacles coiling into unknown territory, until the view on the core of the plant itself got obstructed. M had long pretended that she had no roots and no tentacles. She wanted to be the wind. She enjoyed the idea of others thinking that she might be gone, that she could not get caught, keeping relationships blurry. She thought she would be the eternal trickster, no one would catch her swing. But recently, she had injured her ankle during a hike, and she literally got stuck. Stuck on the couch of her parents. She was not able to whirl around much any longer, and realized that whoever wants to be the wind only receives wind back. She could feel the breeze caressing her cheeks, but no one was holding her. Ambiguity is threatening. People don't like it. They want to know, who are you, where are you, what are you doing, will you stay here, what is your next move, can we trust you? Now that M was no longer capable to move easily, she decided that her being the wind had finished. Maybe it was time to become a rock, or a plant with roots in one place. I have not seen her ever since.
Quasimodo representing the unseen. Immortal stats, so we got invisible cling. Advanced rhyme team, out of loop beans. The unseen, we keep it clean. Like a diamond ring, a dirty, like a one night fling. But I bet you can't catch my swing. We roll numbers, stack styles every time we do our thing. Hitting like some linebackers, we ramshackless. You fuck with us, you end up on the blacklist. You rush by tacklers, you ask a fat kiss of death. Like we on the street scene. You and your whole crew retreat, cause y'all ain't got no tricks up your sleeve. While we must rhyme function to a point to where y'all can't even breathe. So make way for the unseen.
In the year 2000, a bad character comes to life. On an album that is a masterpiece of evasive behavior. It's The Unseen by Quasimodo, where Quas is an alter ego of the musician Madlib, who produced, composed, and is the voice of the album. The record is a universe on its own, compressed into a dense 63 minutes. Let's start with a few lines. I bet you can't catch my swing. elevating styles without explication. I ain't the cat you saw yesterday. Curious, ain't you? I'm just testing you. You and your whole crew intrigued because you ain't got no tricks up your sleeve. You have to listen carefully. Make way for the unseen. I admit it's not a very quotable album, and that might be the point. Side note, in Rhythm and Flow, a music competition television show, think of American Idol for hip-hop music, Cardi B, one of the judges, keeps saying every song should have at least one Instagram caption quotable. You can listen to The Unseen for an hour, but I can already promise you, you won't find much to caption. Because there's something else happening on The Unseen, being full of small phrases, of cracks, of skits, of voices that are sometimes amplified and at other moments subdued. There is Madlib, his own voice, difficult to catch, as he splits his personality into his reclusive self and the more outgoing, cheeky character of Quasimodo. As Quas, with his voice pitched up high, he engages often in dialogue with his real voice or self. But what do we consider real here? When thinking of playing a fragment, I realized how hard it is to select a melody or a phrase to convince you of its quality. I didn't find a one-liner. That is the case when we stay with a literal listening, and that's not so interesting here. What interests me more is a half-conscious listening, to make space for where words don't go. And in that space, a lot is said on The Unseen. I'm not able to take a piece of it now. I can't point exactly and say, look, there it is. But I do know it's all over that place. It's in the merging of voices, in the interruptions, in the samples that I would recognize during other seasons, in that area of prepared improvisation. Being unquotable can lead to becoming forgettable. And still, every disappearance is a recording. I met Madlib twice. The first time, about 15 years ago, I was very nervous, because I would interview him, while at the same time I didn't want to know that much. No need to dig for things he clearly didn't want to share. I had seen his previous interviews, where his eyes would look the other way, and answers were never longer than a few words. Our meeting was a strange one. Formalized in a press moment, the scripted situation of an interview. But there was also something informal about it, while we sat down on the grass in the park. Me with a recorder. Out of hearing distance, the people from the record company were lingering behind the trees. I asked my questions. Simple questions. About his family, trust, times and places. And answers came. And with those answers, I later kept on editing until a whole was created, in which something was said while nothing was said. I lost the audio file for over a decade, until I recently found the recording again. My voice is clearly younger there, my accent was different. The voice is hard to hide behind, you can always hear its vulnerability. The second time I met Madlib that same year was after a concert. He was accompanied by a very skilled drummer with beautiful freckles. We went out for a drink, little was said. But what I mainly remember is a moment on the touristy square after soft rain pouring, and how the drummer joked and grabbed my bicycle, jumped on it backwards, cycling away from us without seeing where he was heading. It sounds unlikely, I still don't understand that move, but it happened. Madlib and I watched him magically disappear down the road. When the bike was returned to me again, we hugged. Be safe, he said. And we went our ways. Thank you. During the years when I was still listening to Quasimodo albums, I still thought I needed signs and signals. I would often literally wear them on my sleeve, so the people that I wanted to reach out to could read me. In the Middle Ages, sleeve not only referred to a part of a garment covering the arm, but also to a piece of armor for protecting the arm. When participating in a contest, knights would often dedicate their performance to a lady of the court and drape something of hers, such as a scarf or a ribbon, around their sleeve of armor, which indicated to the tournament spectators which lady the knight favored. This gesture may be the source of the saying, "Wear your heart on your sleeve." The first recorded use of the expression appears in William Shakespeare's Othello, written in 1603, where the villain Iago says, "For when my outward action doth demonstrate the native act and vigor of my heart, in compliment externed 'tis not long after, but I will wear my heart upon my sleeve for those to peck at. I am not what I am." How to interpret this confession? It's unlikely Iago would actually wear his heart on his sleeve, because he knows it will make him weak. But perhaps he would do it in a tactical manner, in order to appear vulnerable, so he can be trusted again. How calculated was my own sleeve from back in the days? An attentive reader would have been able to detect the signs that were once visible directly on my body, in the form of the fabric of a scarf or second-hand clothing revealing specific brands or a display of jewelry, pins, and other accessories. Later, the signs would jump elsewhere. While my physical appearance became more and more subtle, the signs took the shape of pragmatic hashtags, a new profile photo, and the seemingly nonchalant rhythm of likes, stories, tags. I noticed others signaling much more vigorously. The artist who only posts flowers or images of his own text-based work. The poet who became specialized in unspecial photography, often blurry, full of crooked angles, boring hotel rooms, and that is precisely what makes their account so strongly present. By now, I have given up a bit, although a constructed image has always appealed to me. But just like my ambition to wear a uniform, to step out of bed and know what to wear each day and have a defining silhouette, this ambition faded away. And I think I let it fade away on purpose. Styles upon styles upon styles is what I have. You want to diss the fiver, but you still don't know the half. Slowly my clothing changed from carefully coded to something looser, which was easier to apply in different situations. Never too tight, never wearing heels, so that I could move around smoothly, not hindered by certain gazes or grabbing hands, a concealing flexibility. In this flexibility, it feels easier to arrive somewhere, so you can just show up. I don't give everything away, but I'll come with something. The book with dense language that I was referring to in the beginning is In the Break by Fred Moten from 2003. And in the chapter The Sentimental Avant-Garde, he talks about Jacques Derrida, who decides to improvise on a discursive event in 1977. And to only carry a small phrase with him. And Moten writes 25 years after this event, "If something is to happen, you have to come unprepared, unarmed, but you don't come with nothing. You've got to bring something that adorns you, even if it doesn't arm you. Just a very small phrase, if it is one, just the spirit of some phrasing, the soft record of a small accompaniment." Let's not put so much attention on the French philosopher, because before you know it, the phrase becomes a fig leaf. And that's not what we want here. We want a soft record of a small accompaniment. Yes, I would drape it over my shoulder. These are steps in preparation. They are preparing for an improvisation. I'm walking through this long, dark corridor and see a lion. I pass it. And I know that if I will pass the bathroom on the left, another lion will appear. I've seen her before. I think it's a she. She carries some soap in her mouth and hairs in her eyes. I've seen her before because we keep each other company in the mornings when I brush my teeth over here. The lion doesn't make me afraid anymore. But yeah, it's midnight and I'm here alone. The lights are turned off and I waited until the others left. Until Tim said, "I will put out the lights now, good night." But I tiptoed back into this corridor, Tim, because I have to do something tonight. There is a cut to be made. Yes, I want to make a cut. A cut, a rip, a slit, a slash, an incision, a tear. So there we are. A cut, a rip, a slit, a slash, an incision, a tear. So there we are. I look around. This space already has a diagonal line. And I want to make a different one. There is this artwork cutting through. It consists of pieces of a bright blue fence supported by concrete. I look around. The other artwork that is cutting through the space I'm confronting with is a 12 meter high curtain. It's semi-transparent, elegant, mesmerizing. It can be moved around and take over most of the wall of this old church. It's an artwork by Jesse Jones and depicts the arm of Silvia Federici. The arm is stretching out, fingers to the sky. It feels like the arm is casting a spell, but I feel safe by it. I'm resting my back to the corner as far as possible. And from here I can make that line. A straight line, a diagonal line, a cut through the space. Okay. A slit, a tear, a rip, an incision. Because there was something about the text. And I could have just made an edit on the page. But the text doesn't exist on the page. It exists as a sound, as a narration, a presence. So if the text isn't present on the page, but somewhere else, then the editing should also happen somewhere else. And tonight that editing takes place here. I'm cutting it apart. Not to divide the text or to delete it. It's not like you're tearing a sheet of paper apart and then throw it away in the trash bin. No, I want to make a cut and then look at the pieces that are left. A cut. It's just an opening, right? If I move back and forth a few times, will the incision become deeper? I'm reminded now of Marta Ram Fortuyn. She gave a lecture 2 years ago. It didn't look like a lecture, like she was freestyling, but she knew exactly what she was doing. And she talked about an elevator, making this vertical line in a hotel in New York that now was a boutique destination, but once was a more rough space. And that there were videos of young RuPaul, who lived there in the 80s, taking the elevator. Marta mentioned that her work was about incisions, and I could see that elevator,
making a cut between different eras, tangled webs of people, experiences, different anticipations. I'm also reminded of Gio, who talked about crossing a bright street. I see him making a cut too. And I'm thinking of O and his lucky sweater. It has holes and rips in it, but it is the most beautiful garment. Sometimes a cut needs to be made. Tonight is that night. Music?
B is a geodesic line stretching 1950 kilometers across Western Europe, a diagonal joining Finisterre to the French Riviera, cutting course in half and traveling along Italian coasts across Sicily and above Mount Etna. It links two irrelevant places, far from any center, moderately attractive for tourism. The village of Milo, on the mountainside of Etna, near Catania in Sicily, and Terenet, a small locality in Brittany, at the entrance of Morlaix Bay and its several notorious islets. B is a residency with no compulsory production, no theme, no company registration number needed, no grants, no participation fees, no educational workshops, no studio, no artistic research, no equipment, no insurance, no obligation of being free of all professional activities during the residency, no contract, no visibility. B offers accommodation, glitter sunscreen, some meals, and possibly a bike. The application must be sent by email before the 29th of May 2019, without any attached file, no resume, no portfolio, no project, no motivation letter, no reference letter, no filled form attached, nor any other document explaining the candidate's practice. I read the soberly designed PDF. This text was so peculiar, I had to apply. It took me 1 minute to send an almost empty application email titled "Taking a Leap." 4 weeks later, I received a reply. "Congratulations, you are selected." I wondered what the selection procedure had been based on. Early September, I was on my way to Sicily. I had decided to not do any research, avoiding the urge of Googling the background of the other people I would meet. All I knew was that I would stay in a house somewhere in Milo, a village on the mountainside of the Etna volcano, in the company of 7 strangers. The past weeks had been hectic. To keep myself standing, I started to wear even looser clothes than I would usually do. A heavy cotton white t-shirt, an oversized silk men's shirt, jeans with a baggy fit covering me from waist to ankles. Layer upon layer upon layer is what I have. But as soon as the door of the plane opened, it became clear I was wearing way too many clothes for the humid warmth surrounding me. I looked at my phone. A message from someone named Enrico appeared. "I wear a yellow t-shirt," he typed. "I wear too many clothes," I responded. "I wear yellow socks," he texted. "I will go to the exit now and see you there," I replied. Not even 30 minutes later, after passing dusty roads with rubble piled up against fences that were overgrown by cacti carrying their ripe orange fruit, there was the hotness of sand almost burying soles of feet, reassuring sounds of waves mixed with the chatter of families on a day out, The repetition of jumping in the sea, each time the pleasant surprise of the warmth of the water, seeing airplanes departing and arriving in the distance. Drying up, salt on skin, a sip of water, rest in the small strip of shadow against the wall. Repeat again. I arrived, and I didn't even have to introduce myself. It took not much time to peel off layers, so the sprout could become unwrapped again. It took 8 strangers who met up without any further introduction. It took peaches for breakfast, making a bed on the floor of the kitchen, woolen blanket, 70s orange, a 10-hour hike to the volcano, silk pajama pants resting on endless hills of black lava stone, red wine from plastic bottles, a crate of 23 kilos of tomatoes, singing along with Lizzo in the car, cutting 23 kilos of tomatoes, bruschetta, sugo, parmigiana, finding a deserted house, making plans for a deserted house, conversations during cutting tomatoes, spitting on dusty tiles of the floor of a deserted house, colors brightening up again, stroking agave leaves, leaves that mark each other, shadows, forgetting about makeup, wearing borrowed woolen jumpers, an improvised family in woolen jumpers, red wool mixed with golden threads, sea green soft wool, classic broken white lamb's wool, enough options for the 8 of us. Breaks at the bar. Granita, quinotto, arancini. Loitering close to a river. Throwing pebbles. A night drive to a small village on the mountain. Lizzo playing in the car. Climbing the mountain. Overseeing not much. Shadows. Boarding for the airplane back, I felt lighter. The silk oversized shirt felt like a better fit, no protection needed anymore. One day after the week in Sicily, I attended an opening in a darkened exhibition room, where visitors were brought into tune with the sound works presented. I talked with someone else who was also part of the show. She had twinkling eyes and was wearing a simple black sweater with a white logo, a parody on Comme des Garçons. We never met before, but had an energized conversation. And then somewhere in the middle of this, she said, I hope you don't find me too direct, but I think you look very professional. I wonder what it all meant. Thought of woolen jumper, silk pajama pants on the volcano, an oversized shirt, days of not introducing or explaining oneself. Just the spirit of some phrasing.